There we go. There we go. All right, what's going on, everyone? Today we have a really special guest. We got Director of Safe Passage for Ukraine, Rachel Jameson. They're doing amazing things out there in Ukraine, obviously, with everything going on. And Rachel, thank you for coming on. How are you doing today?
Good, good. I actually just drove back from the Ukraine border in a snowstorm, so happy to be warm and at home now.
Right. So yeah, I know you told me that before we got started. So you drove from. So where did you drive from?
I drove. It's kind of a village in the border area. kind of hard to even describe where it was. But I was down there looking for a location for our reintegration program that we're setting up to work with foreign military volunteers who worked in Ukraine. And so I just happened to be there, and then there was a major snowstorm that hit and had to make it all the way back. So that was quite.
So are you? I'm going to go into all the things that you do, obviously. But are you in Ukraine currently?
I am not. Right now, I'm in Poland. I split my time between Poland and in Abu Dhabi, the United Arab Emirates, which is where my regular job is.
Right.
I actually haven't gone into Ukraine yet, although a lot of Safe Passage volunteers are in Ukraine right now.
Okay. And what do they say, like, the experience on the ground is like, the volunteers?
You know, I think the major thing that I've heard is that Ukraine is a lot different from any other war or conflict zone. You know, I've worked in quite a few other places that are experiencing conflict or post-conflict. And the interesting thing about Ukraine is that, you know, if you are on the front line, it's some of the most intense combat that people have ever seen. You know, this is
wow.
Like World War I style trenches there, and there's
right.
Artillery coming down. And then there's also places in Ukraine like Lviv or Lutsk or places, you know, Western Ukraine, where people are living their life as normally. And there's still a threat there, but you don't, even if you get a few miles off the front line, it doesn't feel like you're there. And that contrast, I think, is very strange to people observing it. I think the other thing too, is that from what I've seen, I was just looking at video and photo that our volunteers sent from Kherson today, and that some of the devastation is really things that it's hard to believe that it exists. Like, looking at it, it's just quite shocking. And I think that's something that I've gone kind of numb to it, you know, working on this for so long. And I think I forget that not everybody sees this all the time. And it's really quite something to observe and go through.
Right. And that's why I do this podcast, to kind of bring attention
yeah.
and exposure to the Western world, obviously, with the things going on there. Now, you mentioned that there's kind of a contrast between Western Ukraine and Eastern Ukraine. Why is that? Why is the fighting sort of, you know, concentrated in that Eastern portion?
That's a good question. So, you know, Russia has claimed that there are, you know, parts of Ukraine that want to secede and join Russia, Luhansk and Donetsk, primarily, as well as Crimea, which they illegally seized in 2014. So most of the fighting has been concentrated around those regions in eastern and southern Ukraine. It hasn't made it into western Ukraine. However, I think there's still no part of Ukraine that is completely safe. There have been rockets that have hit all parts of it. I think the difficult thing in Ukraine as well is that Russia does not respect any law of war. You know, in war, you're not supposed to intentionally target civilians. In this case, though, we know and we have observed that Russia has often intentionally targeted civilians. And so there is no really safe place anywhere in the country.
Right. So I wanted to get into this a little bit later, but since you brought it up that, you know, Russia, some might say they intentionally target civilians, obviously they're especially brutal. With the work that you do, have you ever been a target of intimidation or anything like that? Or your organization, has it been like a target for the Russian military?
Yeah, actually. So when I first got involved, actually, a few days afterwards, I was doxed online. My location was doxed, and it said, you know, my name, my address, and where I was, and said, when she goes dark, I want credit for the kill, which going dark is, you know, a euphemism for killing. So I actually had to,
right.
I was outside the US at the time, I had to get in a flight. I've had other threats since then. Nothing against me that has really, really amounted to a very, very serious thing. But the fear is still always there. For our volunteers in country, we haven't had anything directly targeted at any of them. However, you know, there's always a risk of just kind of being in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Of course.
We do also work with, one of the things that we work with, and this is actually the bulk of my work actually is in this part of the program, is that we work with foreigners who are serving in Ukraine. So either in the International Legion with Ukrainian army, or, you know, with one of the many kind of different groups that are on the ground operating there. And if they're injured, we help them go home, get out of the country, get a flight home, and get them counseling, get them medical services that they need. A lot of them have received threats. They've been kind of doxxed online of being called a mercenary. Their families have received threats, sometimes very, very, very disturbing ones. And that's something that's really hard to witness, because especially the ones against their families can be quite scary. It's very hard to scare somebody who's willing to be in a trench in the front line,
right?
Unless you threaten their family, that is.
Right. That's, yeah, that's just a completely different level. So I wanted to get into more, you know, what you do. But before we do that, you are the director. So I'm curious, your background, how did you get involved? Why do you feel the need to help? So on and so forth.
Yeah, so my background is actually doing a lot of NGO work. I'm a law professor in my day job, and my entire career has either been working in NGOs and nonprofits or in academia. And so I came into this with a pretty strong background in working in NGOs and working in some tough places. I've worked in Tanzania, in Uganda, in Sierra Leone, and in Lebanon, where I set up an NGO as well. And then in terms of an academic, I focus mostly on skills-based training. I train future lawyers how to argue, essentially. And so I've worked in China and the UAE for that. How I got involved in Ukraine is actually, it's admittedly a pretty wild story here. I have the great fortune of having had a lot of students who've come out of Ukraine. I teach at New York University in Abu Dhabi, and we have quite a few students who come from Ukraine, some of our strongest, best students, actually. And I coach debate and had a lot of them in there, or my classes in argumentation. And so when this started, actually, I knew a lot of people. I knew a lot of people I cared about. Ironically, the invasion was February 24th. February 23rd, I taught a lesson at the school of, like, how do you approach different arguments about Ukraine? Should Russia should invade, should it not? What would happen? And it caught, like, I think within 2 hours, the invasion started after that. So when this happened, I knew lots of people. I had some terrifying phone calls, you know, with people I knew on the ground and people wondering that, you know, were they going to make it out? But I also felt helpless and didn't know what I could do. You know, I'm not someone who's trying to fight. That's not my skill set. And so what I did was I went on Reddit and I posted a couple different forums, mainly the Reddit Ukraine subreddit, of saying I had airline miles for combat veterans or medics if anybody wanted to fly to Ukraine and volunteer. And meant to just find about probably two people and that would be it. instead, I kind of lit a beacon there. And I had most of the future International Legion contacted me. Lots of people wanted to go to volunteer in Ukraine, tons of Army and Marine Corps veterans. And also lots of people who wanted to volunteer their own airline miles as well. And ended up kind of setting up a system to match them up with it. I did that for a bit of time, but as I was sending people over there, you know, I kept in contact with a lot of them, built that network, and ended up with one of, I would say, most diverse networks in Ukraine, because, you know, I already have my NGO network of people who, you know, what we do is work in conflict. What we do is work in difficult situations, NGOs. And then I also had a network of, through my students, lots of Ukrainians I knew, as well as the military. And these are groups that don't normally talk to each other, to our detriment, I would say. The reason I set up Safe Passage was in recognizing that there, if, you know, the airline mile system could work for people going over to volunteer, then there's way more people leaving Ukraine who are going to need that help.
Right.
And Igor, one of our volunteers who is Ukrainian and who worked to set this up with me, commented about, you know, how much money he had to spend helping his own family and friends get out because of, you know, the airline algorithms shot up the price of flights with it, you know, because of the demand. And so there's, you know, a huge problem with this. The other thing, so I wanted to work with refugees coming out of Ukraine and use that same system to help them. The other thing is that the people who I was sending over, helping get over there to help fight or helping to, you know, do medical volunteer work, were telling me, like, what happens if I get hurt? Wow. And I didn't know the answer to that. And nobody knew the answer to that. And so I decided that somebody needed to be the answer and kind of became the answer with this, of helping the foreign military volunteers as well. And so that was really the impetus to how this all started and what it became now.
That's honestly incredible. And like I said, I can't thank you enough for the work you're doing. It's simply incredible. So now that the war's been raging on for, I believe, about, correct me if I'm wrong here, I think about 10 months.
Yeah, close to 10 months. Yeah.
How many people would you say have been, I guess, displaced in Ukraine, and what is their experience like?
So I think the most current numbers are that 12 million people have fled Ukraine, actually. The number displaced internally is much higher than that. And I'm not sure the actual number, but it's staggering. So, Ukraine is a huge country. I think 43 million people maybe is the count. I think, what was the second part of your question? Can you restate it?
What is their experience like? Pretty much.
Yeah, so I can say of the people that we worked with, we've seen some devastating things. Of a lot of people have lost everything. You know, they are people who in Ukraine, they had an education, they had a family, they had a house, they had a life that they lived, that they were loving. And then for a lot of them, it's gone now. Their house may have been hit by a rocket, or even if it's still there, it's not a safe place that they can go to. And I'm trying to kind of imagine myself in that situation of suddenly, if, you know, one day I have this life, if this is how I live, and then the next day I'm fleeing the country and I have nothing. And I think the difficulty in Ukraine as well is that, you know, Ukraine is a country that has low salaries in comparison to the rest of the world. So in Ukraine, you might be living a very nice life. If you were earning, for example, $500 US dollars a month, and then suddenly you have to leave, and in comparison, you have absolutely nothing and you're destitute. And so I think that is something that we've just observed over and over again of people having nothing and trying to get them to a place where they can rebuild is really it's something that we're proud to do, but it's also difficult to observe that over and over. I know of our volunteers in Kherson right now, as they've been kind of going to different villages and places around the city, a lot of them have sent me messages talking about just how disturbing it is to see this. And I think that's something that when the invasion first started, you know, the world really cared about Ukraine and donations flooded in. Tons of people flew there to volunteer, even not even knowing what they were going to do. As it's drawn on, this has become kind of normal. And I think we all need to remember, actually, like, it's not normal to be living where you don't know when your house will be hit by a rocket. It's not normal, you know, even if you've made it to a safer place in Ukraine, you're still no longer safe. You're still no longer at home. Like, all these things are major, major disruptions in their lives.
Right. And unfortunately, that's a sad reality of war, but that's kind of where your organization steps in. So I'm curious, what exactly do you guys do? What services do you offer the Ukrainian population who are displaced? I know there's, like, you listed five things on your website, so I'm curious if you could just expand on that.
So the major thing that we do, and this is, I think, the bulk of our program, is that we are the link of getting people to safe long-term destinations. And so we primarily work with people who are headed to the US or Canada. They have often have family there or a friend who's going to host them and help them out. Or there's somebody who has found a sponsor or found kind of a long-term plan of this is where I'm headed and this is where I'm going. And so we work with donors who provide airline miles or hotel points to fund them and get them to the next place. And when I say that we work with them, we don't just book a ticket. We really have a case manager who works with them and makes sure that their plan is actually viable. We don't want to fly anybody and have them end up in a more dangerous situation. And so that's a lot of what we do. I think our current count is about 185 people we've flown so far through that, and it goes up all the time. We also have about I think it's about 7,500 people that we've helped get out of dangerous situations in Ukraine and to safer parts of Europe. The other part of what we do is that we do ground evacuations in Ukraine, and this we do it a little bit differently, I think, than some other groups that people kind of get this image in their head of, you know, going to the front lines and evacuating people out. We primarily focus on transport for really vulnerable people, so people who are elderly, disabled, the very young. People who can't just get in a train and get out themselves. There's a reason why they need some assistance to
Yeah, of
get
course.
out. Yeah. And so we work with sometimes you give them their own transport, or we have volunteers who get in a train with them and leave. The next part of what we do, and this is the newest part, is that we distribute winter supplies as well as Christmas toys in country. And so we are primarily focused on getting generators to people right now, as well as thermal clothing and the things to kind of survive there. As I mentioned before, we also work with military volunteers. And so it's a similar thing there where if they need to get out of the country and need transport out due to their injury, we're happy to help them with that. And then also get them donors who cover their airfare costs home. I think one thing that a lot of people don't realize actually about the foreigners who've gone there to assist Ukraine is that they're either unpaid or paid very little. And so you can encounter somebody who it usually costs about $10,000 to get all the equipment that you need to actually be on the front line. Those things are really expensive. They have to pay for themselves. And they have either not been being paid or been paid very little that entire time. And so we have a lot of people who contact us who literally don't have the money for the flight home.
Right. Okay. So, I mean, it's truly astounding how you're able to set up such an intricate operation in about 10 months. So hats off to you. It's honestly, incredible. So I'm curious about the relocation aspect to it. So obviously you fly Ukrainian refugees and displaced people outside of the country. Does it stop there? Or do you offer any services to get them, you know, acclimated in their new host country? You know, obviously it can be a bit of a culture shock. So what do you do after, you know, a Ukrainian refugee is in another country?
That's a great question. A lot of the work we do to make sure that they succeed afterward is actually before they get on the plane. So we have a pretty extensive list of questions that we ask everybody about where they're going, where they're headed, what the plan is for them to survive, who they're staying with, these sorts of things. Sometimes we've, you know, checked out to make sure that the host family that they're going to is, you know, who they say they are, that kind of thing. We're very wary, especially of, you know, single women or women with kids flying alone. That can be pretty vulnerable situations. We always check out who they are headed to. We do have ways through partner organizations, we link them to resources on the ground. So these can be, you know, help with translation, with medical help, with some players. In Canada, there's some resources that can help them find a job. And so we try and make sure that they have as much information as they can. It is a little bit uneven because some places that they're heading to have far more services than others. So for example, people going to Winnipeg, there's wonderful services on the ground that we can make sure that they know about when they arrive. People headed to New York, you know, not so much. That's there to help them.
Okay. And I'm actually based in New York, so it's unfortunate to hear.
Yeah. It's an expensive place to adapt to.
Definitely. I can attest. So you kind of explained some of the numbers, but if you could just reiterate, how many people have you helped in total? I think it's incredible.
Man, if we really totaled it up, it's probably about close to 8,000 people. We track a little bit separately because there's different groups that we work with, but yeah, all in total, it's about 8,000.
So what are some like problems you encounter, you know, with these operations?
I would say big problems could be like anything can happen in Ukraine. We can have something planned and then suddenly there's missiles that are, you know, landing all over country and we have to suspend what we're doing just for our own safety. You know, anything in Ukraine kind of takes longer and needs to be flexible and needs to adjust to what we're doing. We often have information that comes to us that is either, you know, 90% true, but that 10% missing is what we really need, or it's just hard to know exactly what is happening. And that can be a big challenge, especially working in a conflict zone where things are dangerous. Other challenges are that, you know, we are working with people in the most vulnerable, most terrible moments of their lives, people who have been through a lot. And if you can imagine that, you know, we're helping them, we're helping this family, you know, get out of Ukraine and then on a plane ticket in a way that is exciting. And in a way that's also devastating. And so it's very challenging to make sure that we're working with them in a way that is really making sure that we're helping them, giving them where they're going, giving them all the support they needed. But I can tell you, like, I work on some of the most difficult cases, actually. I primarily work with the people who have been badly injured. And there's, you know, secondary trauma is a very real thing, or vicarious trauma. And right. That's something I think that we all feel working on this. And so I think another challenge is just knowing when you need to take a break. But at the same time, you know, every time I take a break, then my phone, you know, explodes with messages. And so it's this constant balancing act of how do you continue to live your life? You know, I still have a full-time job outside of this. I have other things I would like to do as well. And then I, you know, direct an NGO doing this, and that balancing is very tough.
Right. So you mentioned you helped about obviously 8,000 people. Mm-hmm. You mentioned a lot of these cases are extremely tough. Mm-hmm. Is there any case that kind of sticks out to you in particular?
Yeah, there's a few that stick out. One was a mom and daughter who their house was hit by a missile in Kharkiv and they lost everything, every single thing that they own. And that one sticks out to me because they had a sponsor in the US who has been very generous and very kind and welcomed them in, and they are now doing wonderfully. But it was tough because they both wanted to go there and wanted to go to the US and wanted to stay because they wanted to make an insurance claim with our house. And it was really kind of devastating to watch somebody make this impossible choice of like, do I give up everything and go to where I know it's safe? Or I, but also give up, everything that I've ever worked for. And that one was hard to watch. There's a few that stick out to me as well. Some of the military cases have hit close to home for me because it's people that I knew. In some cases, the people that we have helped get out to the injury are people that I flew over myself. And so, or sometimes just watching the names come in because I get the updates of who's injured and realizing this is a person I know, this is a person I recognize is extremely difficult. I think those would be the big ones for me that really stand out.
Now, on that same point, I guess, do you have any, I guess, feel good stories that, some people could kind of take solace
Oh yeah, we
in?
there's some great ones actually. I think one of my favorite ones, we worked with a mom and daughter who left Ukraine and they've now resettled in Minnesota and they give us updates a lot and they're just thriving. Their host family has become their family. The daughter is a really bright kid and she's now in school and just really doing really well. I think there's a lot of similar stories to those like that of people who've arrived in their new home and we get just smiling photos of them doing tremendously well. We also we just distributed winter supplies and Christmas toys in country and like the smiles you see in the kids when they get to pick out their own toy like after months of just like
Yeah.
it's like you get to get whatever you want. It's pretty awesome to observe that. I also have had with the military cases that I work on, a lot of them are people I work with either kind of they're men of few words. They don't say much, but
Right.
occasionally they'll reach out and they'll just say something like, I want you to know that you saved my life and just know that. And that's all they will say. But that's something that it's really touching. And some of them have actually given some some things that mean a lot to me. There's a few units where they all have patches of people who are in the unit together, and a couple of them have given me like an honorary patch as well, and that's something
Oh
that
wow.
I'm going to keep for life there.
Right. So here in America, like we obviously only get our information in the Ukraine war from some of our major news outlets. We don't really have the opportunity to really kind of like dig deep and learn a little bit more about it. So what would you say are some of the common misconceptions that us Americans kind of have about maybe the war in general or just displaced Ukrainians?
That's a great question. So the main misconception I think I have is that we get a lot of Ukraine is winning the war and Ukraine is wonderful and they're amazing and they are like their military is doing tremendous things. I think we don't hear enough about the cost of what that is. And so it's the lives lost, the lives just disrupted. I had one of my students has a childhood friend of hers who supplies the front line. And the way he describes it, he says Ukrainians don't measure time in actual time. Ukrainians measure time and how many people they know that have died, and that keeps going up and up. And I think that's something that we don't hear about that cost of it. I think the other thing as well is that there's, I think most Americans don't, a lot of them I've talked to don't quite understand why do Ukrainians need to come to the US? Like they can stay in Europe. Why can't they stay over there? And I think there's value in letting people choose where they go. That some people might have made it out of Ukraine and perhaps are in Poland, but Poland has taken in millions of refugees. Their generosity is just astounding in taking them in. But many Ukrainians, for example, they might speak fluent English and be really ready to adapt in the US. There's a lot of Ukrainian Americans, Ukrainian Canadians that have family. Those families are separated. And I think understanding that, we have a duty and we have an obligation as part of the world to take people in and to do what we can for them is something that lots of people enjoy, but I would love to see it more widespread.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think those are the biggest. I think another misconception is just we've worked with a lot of people that I think it's tough to understand just how big Ukraine is actually and just how massive this is. The front line essentially extends from north of Europe like all the way down to Italy if you actually kind of line it up
Look at a
that
map,
way.
yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And like I mean, I was somebody who like I never learned really anything about Ukraine when I was a kid or in school, and have kind of been educated. And I, one misconception I think Americans have is that Ukrainians and Russians are culturally quite close, or you have a lot of historical ties. And in a way, that's a way you could phrase it. I think the way a lot of Ukrainians would like people to look at it is that they have been colonized by Russia, and that they have been abused and mistreated by Russia for centuries. And this is something that is a part of that. And so I think to them, when Westerners or Americans look at this, is like, oh, well, this is, you know, Russia and Ukraine have strong links, strong, you know, lots of Ukrainians speak Russian. To them, that's something that's quite offensive, and in a way that was actually something I really had to learn in working on this.
Right. So you mentioned a lot about, like, you know, wishing that the whole world would kind of, you know, help Ukrainians and open their borders and stuff. I'm curious about the countries. We talked about the US and Canada. Curious about the countries bordering Ukraine. You mentioned Poland's been extremely cooperative, which is obviously awesome. How have the neighboring countries been responding to the refugee issue? So like Romania, I'm trying to think of all the countries that border Ukraine. Can't really think of them off the top of my head, but you know, aside from Poland, how are the neighboring countries kind of dealing with the refugee issue? Have they been open to accepting refugees?
Very mixed. So of course, Belarus to the north is one that, you know, is constantly risk of, like, will they join the war? Will they invade? Because they have Lukashenko in charge. So that one has, of course, not been so welcoming to Ukrainians. Romania and Poland, I think, have been incredibly welcoming and doing the best that they can. However, you know, Romania is not a wealthy country itself. The Czech Republic, I don't have a ton of information actually on there. We've handled very few cases coming out of there. Hungary, though, you know, is quite famously not a pro-immigrant kind of country. And so they've been less welcoming to Ukrainians. I think the vast majority of Ukrainians have either come into Poland or have kind of gone through Poland. And so that's been the major receptive point. What I've learned from people being in war, I've primarily been in Warsaw and on the ground here, is that a lot of people have told me that the reason why Polish people have been so welcoming is that they're the one country on earth that can kind of understand that, you know, people from Warsaw have told me only someone from Warsaw could understand what happened to Mariupol, because what happened to Warsaw in World War II was so tragic. You know, the city was leveled, essentially, that they've been through this before. And so they're willing to open their doors to people.
Absolutely. So just going back to the refugees, what kind of issues do you see them dealing with? I guess, like, psychologically, like, do you see a lot of people suffering from PTSD, trauma? What are some of the issues you see the refugees dealing with that maybe aren't, like, you know, tangible or financially related?
Definitely. That's a great question, too. And I think something that's overlooked here. I think, yeah, definitely PTSD and trauma. Some people in Ukraine have been through horrific things. And you know, it's things that they don't want to talk about. Survivor's guilt is another one that we see. You know, a lot of them have lost family members, and they're struggling with that. I think also just cultural adaptation is huge. You know, leaving your home and leaving your language and leaving everything you've ever known and going to a new country is difficult for anybody. And then you compound all these other factors on top of that, and that's a huge challenge for them. One of the groups that we work alongside with as a partner involves a Return Peace Corps volunteers who have volunteered in Ukraine. And they now do some cultural adaptation, you know, training for people who are hosting Ukrainians. And I think everybody who is hosting Ukrainians are wonderful people welcoming their homes. But if you can imagine the challenge of welcoming someone in that you don't know, who might not speak your language, is coming in from a different culture and is going through extreme trauma. And linking that together, we've seen it be a wonderful experience where people really bond. And it can also be very challenging in ways that are difficult to overcome.
Absolutely. So it's been about 10 months since you obviously started Safe Paths for Ukraine. What is one thing, I guess, you've learned about maybe yourself and the people of Ukraine in the past 10 months of doing your work?
I think, you know, I have some Ukrainian students who joke that I'm an honorary Ukrainian, or that they kind of adopted me in. I will accept that.
Definitely deserve it, for 100%.
Yeah, I will take that with pride. And I think that's actually kind of true, because Ukrainians, as I've learned, you know, they're people who stand up for themselves. They have a voice and they will use it. They do not give up. And that's been something that's been consistent in my life. I jokingly tell people this, but I think it's true, is that, you know, we don't have actually that many Ukrainian students at my university where I teach. That the numbers are quite low. It's about 10 per class. I have always known a disproportionate amount of them, a lot of them. And because I teach argumentation, actually, and they would get into lots of battles about, you know, just standing up for themselves in terms of things at the university. I think that this is something that Ukrainians need to take great pride in. And that, you know, when we all watched this happen, I think everybody, myself included, just thought, you know, we were going to watch Ukraine get run over and then Moldova get run over next and who knows what. And Ukraine said, no, we don't do that. That's a lesson for all of us here.
Absolutely. Have you been recognized for your work by, you know, the US government or the Ukrainian government? Have you been like commended for your efforts?
No, I haven't been commended in any way. Most of, you know, this is, I think, the tough thing of like, I kind of do the things in the background here. You know, I do the fundraising, the organizing behind the scenes. I'm the woman on the phone 20 hours a day kind of organizing things. And it's a thing that it's necessary, but it kind of stays under the radar in a way.
Yeah, absolutely. If you need any assistance, I can definitely help you out. I'd be more than willing. I do have one last question for you. And I usually end these interviews with how could, you know, the average American help you or just the people of Ukraine? Obviously, you have a website where people can donate. Yeah. What can we do?
Yeah. So our website is sp4ukraine.org. We've also, if you go there, you've got social medias where, you know, if you're somebody who doesn't know what to do, please follow us. Please tell people about us. That can help us. If you do have airline miles or you've got some hotel points sitting around, I guarantee you there is a person who could, you could use those and you can really change their life with that. The other thing too, is that cash donations, even a small amount, do assist us. So, you know, a lot of what we do actually in Ukraine doesn't cost that much. So the reintegration program that we're setting up costs $40 per person per day. And so for just a small amount of money, you can help somebody adapt back into their own life. A train ticket out of Ukraine for somebody in need who can't afford it is, you know, $40. For one of us, that's very little. For Ukrainian, that's a huge amount of money that could save. And otherwise, to volunteer. So we have, you know, a lot of our work is done by remote volunteers. And sometimes people are thinking like, well, I'm not really suited to go on the ground. You know, I'm not a combat veteran. I can't do anything for Ukraine. That's not really true. Everything that I have done has been done, you know, from my phone, from my computer, essentially, and it's had a huge impact. And so I think a lot of what people need to do is look at what are your skills, not just what are you good at, what are you great at, though, but Ukraine needs it. And whatever that skill is, there's a way for you to get involved either with us or with some other group that's helping and you can be effective.
Absolutely. So what I'll do is at the end of the interview, I include a link in the mm-hmm. description of the interview so people can go there and give for the viewers. Like I said, if you need any assistance, I'd be more than willing to volunteer. So, you know, can't be said enough for you doing incredible things and, hopefully we see a speedy resolution and end to the war. But other than that, Rachel, really appreciate it and, you know, stay safe and thank you so much for coming on. I had a wonderful conversation with you.
No problem. I'm happy to do it and happy to talk to you. But
likewise. All right. Thank you so much. Take it easy.
No problem. Have a good night.
Bye.